Amongst them emerged a scrawny man that she recognised.
"Oh, my God, I remember him," Nikki said.
She turned to Mindy.
"He found your profile on the marriage board, didn't he?"
"How did you know?"
"I met him when I was putting up your profile. He was..." "Oh, hello," Nikki said.
"Hi," Ranjit said with a surprised, nervous laugh.
"You're Mindy's sister."
"Nikki, we've met." Mindy looked back and forth between them.
"If you two met while Nikki was putting up my profile, does that mean you were the first man to see my profile?"
Her eyes brimmed with adoration.
"You guys go ahead," Nikki said when they reached the restaurant. "I'll be there in a minute."
She waited for Mindy and Ranjit to disappear inside and then she lit a cigarette. The pavement glistened with rain and people trotted past, their conversation and laughter mingling with the sounds of traffic. Nikki felt for her phone and then she drew a hand away.
"Don't even think about calling him," she scolded herself.
She only finished half the cigarette before stubbing it out and going into the restaurant. At the table, the waiter asked for their drink orders.
"Shall we share a bottle of wine?" Nikki asked.
Mindy shot a glance at Ranjit.
"I won't have any wine, thanks," she said.
"Ranjit?" Nikki asked.
"I don't drink," he said.
"Oh, right. Guess I'll have the whole bottle to myself then." The waiter was the only one who broke into a smile.
"It's a joke, guys," Nikki said. "Just some sparkling water for me, thanks."
"You can order a glass for yourself if you want," Mindy said.
"That's all right," Nikki said.
She thought she saw Mindy's shoulders drop slightly with relief. They didn't talk about Ranjit on the tube ride home. Nikki waited patiently for Mindy to ask for her opinion. Finally, as they stepped into their house and went up the stairs to their respective bedrooms, Nikki tossed her bag on the bed and followed Mindy into the bathroom.
"Little privacy, please," Mindy said, wiping her eye makeup off.
"You haven't asked me what I think of him," Nikki said.
"I don't need to know," Mindy said.
Both her eyes were closed now as she rubbed the wipe across her lids.
"What happened to wanting my approval? Honestly, I'm reluctant to ask."
"Why?"
"You hardly said anything once our meals arrived. Ranjit tried to get to know you and you gave him one-syllable answers."
"Well, I don't have much to say to a guy like that."
"Like what?"
"You know."
"Enlighten me, please," Mindy said.
"He seems quite conservative."
"What's wrong with that?"
Nikki gave Mindy a long look.
"Is he going to be uncomfortable every time I have a drink? If I smell like cigarettes, is he going to wrinkle his nose at me? Because I felt like the wayward sister, the one who brings down the family's reputation."
"He's working on that," Mindy said.
"He grew up in a traditional family. It freaked him out a bit when I told him that you lived and worked in a pub."
"Does he know about my role in the story classes?"
"Yeah."
"What was his reaction?"
"He was uncomfortable with it."
"What a surprise."
"The point is, he's coming round. He cares so much about me that he wants to be more accepting. It will just take him some time."
"Why be with someone who's making the journey? You could be with someone who's already arrived."
"His traditional values have a good side as well. He's very family-oriented and respectful."
"Nikki, you go on about how narrow-minded everyone else is, yet you think there's only one way to live and fall in love. Anybody who isn't like you is doing it wrong."
"That's not true," Nikki protested.
Mindy tossed the wipe into the bin and pushed past Nikki. She entered Nikki's bedroom and grabbed the letter from her dresser. She waved it at Nikki, who tried to snatch it back.
"What the hell, Mindy?" Nikki cried. "I'm tossing this in the bin. Give it back. I don't know what it says or who it's from, but it's clearly driving you crazy. This has nothing to do with... You're unsettled about something, and I can tell that this letter is connected to it. Every time it catches your eye, you get that same pinched look you have in your face right now, like you're one step away from covering your ears and singing la 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 until you're left alone. Read it, or I'm throwing it away."
Mindy tossed the letter on Nikki's bed and retreated into her own bedroom, shutting the door. Nikki was too taken aback to say anything. She sank back on her bed. Lights from a slowly passing car threw shadows across the ceiling. Mindy could be heard shuffling around her room.
Min? What?
Nothing,
she called back. Silence from Mindy then.
Idiot!
Nikki grinned and scooted towards the wall that they shared. She gave it a hard hit with her heel. Mindy responded by thumping back on the wall with her hand. Just like they used to when they were children. Mindy's side of the wall remained silent for a few moments.
Hey,
she said.
Yeah?
Nikki asked.
You're up later than I expected.
Mindy's syrupy tone suggested that she was not addressing Nikki. Next came a surreptitious giggle. Ranjit was on the phone. Nikki raised her foot, about to thump the wall one last time for good measure, but she decided against it. Instead, she picked up the envelope on her desk, took in a deep breath, and ripped it open. Dear Nikki, I can't expect you to read this letter without feeling hurt and disgusted with me. I lied to you. I had many opportunities to tell you about my marriage and my divorce, but I hid it from you because I was afraid of what it might say about me. Everybody considers my marriage breakdown a failure, and I've struggled to accept it myself. I failed my family, and I failed as an adult. I owe you an explanation, and it's up to you whether you read it. A few years ago, when I finished university and started working, I was expected to get married immediately. As the oldest son, I was pressured by my family to set an example. I would walk in the door after work, and my parents would beckon me to the study to look at the top profiles they had shortlisted from the Indian matrimonial websites. I put off meeting any of these women, wanting to live a free life before settling down. I figured I still had time, but I fought constantly with my parents, and I ended up moving into my own place. Then my mother was diagnosed with cancer. She went through exhausting tests and chemotherapy sessions that wore her down. The pressure began to mount again, from dad, aunties and uncles, and even my younger siblings, who just wanted something to celebrate at a dreary time. The message was clear. Get married, and give your mother just a small sense of peace. I met Sunit on the internet. She lived in London and we got to know each other through patchy Skype calls and email exchanges before I made the decision to visit the UK to meet her in person. I saw the trip as the first stage in the dating process. Our family saw it as a confirmation of our engagement. I got swept up in all of it, even though I was uncertain about how I felt. I told my family that I liked her and it was true. She is a pretty, intelligent, and kind woman who cares very much about traditions and wanted an arranged marriage. There was no reason not to ask her to marry me, especially as my mother's health deteriorated. Time was running out. In the lead-up to the wedding, I had moments of anxiety, but I quelled them by reminding myself that we'd have time to get to know each other after marriage. This custom worked for our parents, and it still works for thousands of Indian couples. Why wouldn't it work for me? We were compatible enough. Most importantly, both our families were thrilled. Although my mother was still weak, my engagement put a spring in her step. My dad and I stopped arguing over everything. It was a peaceful time for our family, and after I'd caused so much unhappiness, I wanted badly to keep this peace. As it turned out, Sunit and I weren't compatible in many other ways that I hadn't considered. There was little sexual chemistry between us, something I dismissed at first because it's not considered a valid reason for separation in our culture. Sunit also wanted children right away, whereas I said we should wait. But Sunit felt pressured by relatives asking her parents when they were going to have grandkids, and I in turn resented Sunit for bowing to those pressures and accused her of risking our happiness just to satisfy our parents. And yet, as I said this to her, I realized that I was also guilty of just that. We grew restless with each other and argued over petty things. In the end, Sunit was the one who suggested divorce. She was weary and growing bitter, and she still had her best years ahead of her. I don't think I understood how much I'd put her through until she said, "You've already taken 2 years away from me. Don't waste any more of my time." I knew that going back to her home as a divorced woman would be shattering. Confronting both our parents with the truth was a ghastly experience. My mom had just begun a round of more successful radiation therapy, and she seemed to be on the mend. Our announcement plunged her back into illness. She stayed in bed for a while, and Dad didn't return my calls. Sunit went through the same at home. I moved into a small flat shared during the divorce, and I was contemplating moving back to California, but the thought of facing my family was too much to deal with. My dad finally returned one of my calls to inform me that my mother's remission was looking hopeful, and I went to the temple to give my thanks. That was the day I met you. But at Sunit's home, things went from bad to worse. Bitter and suffering from a loss of face in the community, her dad launched a character assault on my family and me. He was heartbroken for his daughter. I understand that. But he went around saying horribly hurtful things about my siblings. These rumors traveled back to California through our family networks. It was his intention to ruin the family's reputation in the way that I had apparently ruined his daughter's chances for finding a suitable husband again. When he exhausted this tactic, he attempted to sue me for damages, claiming that I had caused irretrievable harm to the family by divorcing his daughter. Sunit didn't participate in much of this, but she didn't stop him either. Everyone was hurting. Those urgent calls that I had to answer, often when I was with you, were from my mother, Sunit's father, Sunit's father's lawyer, who turned out to be a real dud, an uncle with a law degree from a third-rate Indian university, and my siblings. There was always something going on, and it seemed to be my fault every time. I needed to placate everybody, which involved long conversations and negotiations. I was putting out spot fires that were more demanding than my full-time job. There was a tremendous amount of emotional blackmail. I came close to telling my parents that I knew I wasn't in love with Sunit because I had experienced falling in love with you, and I could see how different it was. But I didn't want to get you involved. I know it seemed like I was creating that distance from you because I wasn't interested, but it was the opposite. I was afraid that if we got closer, things would go disastrously wrong. I wanted to avoid you coming to my flat because I was nervous that someone would see us and accuse me of having an affair and that you would be dragged in. Nikki, it was cowardice that kept me from finding the words to tell you the truth. I regret every second that I've spent without you. It was selfish and dishonest of me to lie and to disappear so many times without explanation. You were so open with me from the first day we met, and I could have repaid you by sharing all of this with you from the start. I'm so sorry, Nikki. I don't expect you to ever want to see me again, but if you did, I'd do anything to gain your trust again. Love, Jason.
Chapter 21. The morning air was crisp, and a mild breeze made Nikki's hands tingle. On the train, she picked up a copy of yesterday's Evening Standard and busied herself with reading old news. The shops were still closed by the time Nikki arrived at Notting Hill Gate Station, but a stream of tourists flowed towards the Portobello Road Market. They stopped to pose for pictures in front of the pastel-painted homes. Nikki headed in the opposite direction towards the cinema, which was still screening the French film that she and Jason had missed. She still had half an hour to kill before the show started, so she carried on ambling. At a traffic light,
a family of American tourists stopped to ask where Hyde Park was. She pointed in its direction, but they wanted her to show it to them on a large unfolded map. She was trying to see where they were on the map when a gust of wind hit the centre crease and ripped it.
"We'll figure it out," the mother of the family said. She took the map back and folded it. "We need this to last us our whole trip," she said.
"That's all right," Nikki said. As the tourists walked away, Nikki overheard the woman telling her husband, "We should ask a person who's from here." Nikki was dumbstruck by their rudeness. The husband turned around then and gave Nikki an apologetic nod. Nikki continued walking, but she was half tempted to go after the woman and tell her that she was from here, thank you very much. She was so lost in a cloud of indignant thoughts that she overshot her mark and found herself on the end of the street, having passed Sally's bookshop. She returned to it and lit a cigarette. Having her claim to Britain taken away from her by an ignorant tourist warranted a satisfying smoke. Nikki peered into the bookshop's window, her eyes trained on the sale bin at the back. Then suddenly a face appeared in the window, and she jumped back, dropping her cigarette on the ground. It was the bookshop's cashier, the woman she'd spoken to last time she visited. The woman knocked excitedly on the window and gestured for Nikki to come inside. Nikki stubbed out her cigarette and went in.
"Sorry for scaring you like that," the woman laughed.
Nikki smiled tightly. Now only two cigarettes remained in her pack, and she was meant to quit after that. The one she had dropped was only half finished, and as she thought of it lying on the pavement, a wave of grief washed over her.
"I just wanted to make sure that I didn't lose you," the woman explained. "You're Nikki, aren't you? I'm Hannah."
She disappeared suddenly behind the counter and popped up again, placing a book in front of Nikki. The Journals and Sketches of Beatrix Potter.
"Oh my goodness," Nikki gasped.
She reached for the book and hesitated, almost afraid to pick it up. Her fingers gingerly turned the cover. The first image was a portrait of Beatrix Potter. Her plump face was slightly angled, and there was a tinge of mischief in her small pursed lips.
"Where did you end up finding this?" she asked. "Special order. It came all the way from India."
There it was, a tea stain the size of a small leaf on the top corner of the cover. It was the very same copy that she had longed for in Delhi all those years ago.
"That's incredible," she said.
She plucked a debit card from her wallet and gave it to Hannah, who waved it away.
"The gentleman already paid for it," she explained.
"Which gentleman?"
"The one who ordered this book. I asked him if he'd rather have it sent to his home or yours, do away with the middleman, but he insisted that we keep it in the shop window in case you walked past. I suppose he wanted to surprise you. I couldn't keep it in the window, though, because that meant it would be available for other customers to purchase, so I had it under the counter. But I looked out for you and told the guys on the late afternoon shift to do the same. But I think they used it as an excuse to lure every girl they fancied into the shop."
Hannah's explanation faded into the distance. All Nikki could think of was the word gentleman. It brought to mind a faceless benefactor in a top hat for some reason, even though she was certain that it was Jason who had placed the order. He would have had to call every bookshop in Connaught Place in Delhi, and she felt a little breathless at the thought.
"Thank you so much," Nikki said.
She clutched the book to her chest and walked outside in a bit of a daze. She passed the cinema, deciding to forego the French film. Trees formed a cozy canopy on the street leading to the gardens. Nikki stepped between the shadows, finding patches of early morning light for momentary warmth. The din of traffic faded once she entered the gates of Hyde Park. Here she walked for a while and found a bench opposite Kensington Palace. The book felt solid in her hands. Nikki ran her hand over the cover and brought the book to her nose to inhale its smell. She always had a small fear that if she ever found this book, it would bring some regret at how she had argued with Dad over it. But with her eyes shut, all she thought of was Jason, the navy jumper he had worn to their first date, the way her stomach flipped when she saw him walk into O'Reilly's. Nikki took some time to examine each page, the letters, the sketchy doodles.
Although the pages were smooth, these pieces felt textured and real, as if she were inside Beatrix Potter's mind. Jason had known just how much it meant to hold this very book in her hands. In the park, tourists weaved purposefully between the more evenly paced joggers and dog walkers. What people wanted from London was all here: the lush green gardens, the majestic domes and church spires, the black cabs busily circling. It was regal and mysterious. She could understand anybody's impatience to be part of it. She was reminded of the widows. They would have known little of this London before their journey to this country, and upon their arrival, they would have known even less. Britain equaled a better life, and they would have clung to this knowledge, even as this life confounded and remained foreign. Every day in this new country would have been an exercise in forgiveness. Nikki picked up her phone and searched for Jason's number.
"I've got 2 cigarettes left and then I'm quitting for good," she said. "You're doing this with me, all right?"
She heard a prolonged sigh, as if Jason had been holding his breath, waiting for her to call. "Save me one," he said. Nikki told him where she was and she waited, watching a group of elderly cyclists rolling past slowly as they breathed in the crisp spring air. She couldn't wait to see him. She couldn't wait for them to begin again.
Chapter 22. Colwinda's new office gleamed. She sat in a chair with a headdress and wheels on its feet. A large window framed the summer sky in a perfect blue square. Colwinda couldn't see the old building from here, and she was surprised that she missed it. True, it had been cramped and mouldy, and the building itself could use a few renovations, but at least she didn't have to be next door to the men of the association. They lingered, as if her open door was an invitation to stare, like she was a curious display. The woman who had rounded up all those old BBs to make demands at the Sikh Community Association meeting. "Not demands," Colwinda reminded herself. "Reasonable requests. Funding for a proper women's centre, one that would provide free services like legal advisers for victims of domestic violence and a dedicated fitness centre where women could exercise without being harassed." Still, Colwinda chuckled at the memory of the men's appalled expressions when she said,
"Take the time you need to consider our proposal, but I want to be present at every discussion from now on. No more impromptu decisions made in the men's cliques in the Langad Hall. Is that clear?"
When nobody protested, she nodded and said,
"Good. We all agree then."
There was a light knocking sound.
"Come in,"
Colwinda said. The door remained shut. There was another louder knock. This was another thing to get used to in the new office. A more solid door blocked out the outside sounds but muffled her responses.
"Come in," she shouted.
The door opened.
"Nikki!"
Colwinda hurriedly closed the newspaper as the girl approached her desk. Colwinda stood to hug her and noticed that her postman bag was missing. In its place was a backpack that bulged with books.
"You've been studying hard," she commented. "Oh, I've some catching up to do. University starts up in a few weeks and I had such a long time away. I'm sure it will all come back to you. I've got a few new things to learn. The course is slightly different."
Nikki was so excited when she was offered one of the remaining spots in this program, a law degree with an emphasis on social justice.
"I want to help prevent what happened to girls like Maya,"
she had said when she rang Colwinda to tell her the news, which made Colwinda's heart swell with pride. And then, in Nikki fashion, she had rattled on about women's rights, except this time Colwinda paid attention.
"And there might be more unsolved cases like Gulshan's and Karina's killings. So few people questioned those girls' deaths that it made it okay to continue the violence. Who knows? We might have grounds to open investigations for Gulshan and to open up Karina's case again. I'm looking into ways to encourage conversations about honour crimes in communities like ours."
"Ours." Colwinda's throat tightened with emotion. Nikki nodded at the newspaper.
"Anything new?"
she asked. Nothing, Corwinda sighed. It'll take time, Nicky said. I know it's hard to wait, though. Juggy was awaiting trial, and that was all the information they had. She checked the paper habitually for updates, but with the passing of each day, she grappled with her disappointment. A part of her had hoped that he would be thrown straight into jail once Nicky had found the registration form among her belongings. Why did they need to ask him any more questions when the handwriting clearly matched? But the lawyers had explained something about due process of law and following procedures, which Corwinda had to accept. At least she and Saurabh had lawyers now. Gupta and co. solicitors had come forward with an offer to fight Maya's case for free. They assured Corwinda that they had a good case and they were confident about defeating Juggy's defense team when the time came. Corwinda was full of gratitude, but she kept thinking that there was a catch to this whole no-fee agreement, even though Mr. Gupta himself explained it was an act of community service. Nevertheless, once a week, she walked to his office on the Broadway and delivered a box of laddus to the receptionist. Nicky pulled up a chair. This is a lovely office, much bigger than the old one. Corwinda looked around. Thank you, she said with pride. She ran her fingers lightly over the smooth surface of her desk. I came here with some exciting news, Nicky said. Your sister is engaged, Corwinda said. No, not yet, Nicky said. She's seeing someone, though. Or a nice boy. Yeah, Nicky said. He's quite nice. She's happy around him. Good, Corwinda said. She was mildly disappointed. It had been a long time since she'd attended a wedding in London. It would be nice to wear gold again. What was your news, then? Nicky took in a breath. We're being published. Corwinda stared at her and said nothing. Nicky had to be joking. The stories? Those ones? She pointed at the photocopied collection on her desk, with its flimsy spiral binding that had begun to uncoil from use. There were other copies floating around Southall and beyond, but this was the original. Those very ones, and possibly more. A company called Gemini Books wants to publish erotic stories for Punjabi widows. Nicky unzipped her bag and pulled out a thick stack of pages that she handed to Corwinda. It was a publishing contract, full of jargon and complicated sentences that Corwinda didn't understand, but she made a show of arranging her glasses on her face and pointing to specific clauses as if she appreciated their inclusion. What language will they be published in? Corwinda asked. They're bilingual publishers, and they're willing to have both Gurmukhi and English script. I told them that there are plenty more stories being written, and they've offered us the opportunity to keep on publishing with them in a series. This is wonderful news, Corwinda said. Will we be able to keep some copies here for people to borrow? I'm sure we can. They can also buy the books. The profits could go into funding the Women's Centre. Oh, Nicky, Corwinda said. This is even better news than an engagement. Nicky laughed. Glad to know it. Speaking of the Women's Centre, have you given any more thought to my offer? A week ago, Corwinda had called Nicky to ask her if she would teach a few classes. Nicky had seemed hesitant. Her shifting body language told Corwinda that she was probably going to say no. It's a great opportunity, Nicky said. But I'm afraid that with all my study commitments this year and living so far away, I won't be able to. Where are you living? Enfield, Nicky said. With your mum? Temporarily, Nicky said. I'll probably share a flat with my friend Olive next year. You'll need a job then, Corwinda reminded her. Rentals are expensive. Nicky probably thought she was desperate, but nowadays there was no shortage of people wanting to teach in the Women's Centre. Word had spread in the community, and potential tutors called every day to inquire about vacancies. The widows want you back, Corwinda explained gently. I miss them, Nicky said. I'm keeping in touch with them. I saw Arvinda, Manjeet and Preetam in the Langar Hall just now,
and Sheena and I are having coffee later.
You could see them all the time. Sheena is going to teach the internet class. The others have enrolled.
I need to focus on my studies for now, Nikki said. Honestly, I'd love to otherwise.
Corwinda understood. All of those books in Nikki's bag needed to be read, and who knew how long that would take.
Still, there were ways of reminding young people of their duties.
Corwinda winced and clutched at the fabric of her blouse in the middle of her chest.
What's wrong?
Nikki asked.
Me? Nothing,
Corwinda said. She kept her features stretched with pain for a moment before relaxing. It was working. Nikki looked worried.
Should I take you to a hospital?
Nikki asked.
No,
Corwinda said.
It's just my acid reflux condition. I get these pains. They get worse as I get older.
Actually, the doctor had given her samples of a new medication that let her eat as much achar as she wanted. No consequent bloating or burping.
I'm so sorry, Nikki said.
There are days when I just need to be at home, Corwinda said, not worrying about how to staff my classes.
Have you got a class on Sundays?
Nikki asked.
No, don't trouble yourself. You are very busy with your studies.
I could travel here on Sundays.
Corwinda knew the timetable by heart. No classes were allocated to Sundays, because that day was usually dedicated to weddings and special prayer programs at the temple.
We can't pay you to run a Sunday class.
So don't.
I'll volunteer, Nikki said. I'll come in on Sundays to run an English writing class or a conversation workshop. People can drop in if they want. I couldn't ask you to do that, Corwinda said.
I'll find the time, Nikki said. I should be part of this place. You should be taking care of yourself.
It's just my stomach, Corwinda said.
Yeah, like my mother's migraines, Nikki said wryly,
triggered during arguments, and then mysteriously cured when she wins.
Corwinda gave Nikki a weak smile and a final wince for good measure. After Nikki left, Corwinda stood by the window. From up here, life in Southall shrank to miniatures. People and cars and trees she could collect in the palm of her hand. No wonder the men always seemed so high and mighty during meetings. They watched the world from this vantage point, and it looked insignificant. Just look at that cluster of widows weaving through the parked cars like ghosts. They could be scrunched up pieces of paper. Corwinda cast a weary glance over her office and made a decision. She would do the official paperwork here, but she would make it a point to spend most of her time on the ground with the women. She should start now. As she moved away from the window to pick up her bag, she saw Nikki's tiny figure crossing the lot. A young man was waiting for her. It had to be Jason Bumra. Corwinda had heard from the widows that they were an item now. She saw them meeting, their limbs bumping in playful greeting. Nikki tossed her head back and let out a laugh as Jason whispered into her ear. Corwinda turned toward the temple and uttered a quick prayer in gratitude of pleasure. The sensation of contact, the anticipation of a kiss, or a brush of Sarab's hand across her bare thigh. Such moments were minuscule, but they amounted to a lifetime of happiness. That was Erotic Stories for Punjabi Widows by Bali Kaur Jaswal, read by Meera Sayal. This program was produced by ID Audio for Harper Audio. Text copyright Bali Kaur Jaswal, 2017. Production copyright 2017 by HarperCollins Publishers, all rights reserved. Bali Kaur Jaswal asserts the moral right to be identified as the author of this work. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.